It's Main Street on a Wednesday in April. I'm Eric Dethridge in for Craig Blumenschein. Great to have you. And yes, the weather's warming up, so I hope that's putting a spring in your step today. Hey, if you're like me and you're a fan of The White Lotus, you're still marinating that season 3 finale. Don't worry, no spoilers here in case you didn't see it. If you've never watched it before, the HBO series about rich folks on vacation and the trouble they get in is set in beautiful Thailand. Luckily, you don't have to go that far to get some good, authentic Thai cuisine. Thai food meets North Dakota at Thai Coda. That's coming up on this week's Prairie Plates as Rick Guillen and I take you to that eatery. But first, in addition to the story of our first residents, immigrants are the story of America. Prairie Public Director of Radio Ann Alquist has the story of one.
Prairie Public has a new local production out. It's called Chosen Home. And we're joined today by Siham Ahmadi, who is one of the people featured in Chosen Home, one of many people. But one of the things that I was really struck by, Siham, was that you are part of a Kurdish diaspora in the Fargo-Moorhead area, which I was unaware of how significant this diaspora was. And as I was watching the local production and they showed the map, and it was one story right after the other, and then your story came up about your family's journey to the Fargo-Moorhead area. So I'd like for you to share your specific story, which is different than some of the other stories that we heard from your Kurdish cousins.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, thank you for having me here. It's interesting to look back. So I appreciate the opportunity again. So
you came here as a small child.
Yeah.
So you're looking back because now you must be in your late 20s or early 30s, I think.
Mid 30s now, almost. Oh my gosh.
It is a reflective period of time. Tell us a little bit about how you prepared for the interview and how you came to the decision to tell your story publicly, because this is broadcast on Prairie Public. You're here today, so you're obviously ready to share, because there were some other people interviewed who were a little uncertain about sharing their story. So I'd love to hear how you came to that decision point and then what your story is, because it does involve civil strife in a part of the world that we don't hear a lot about.
So I heard about the documentary. It seemed like a great opportunity, and I really try to spread it to my network because I feel like these stories need to be told. Like you said, you had no idea of the Kurdish diaspora that's in Fargo-Moorhead, and it's pretty significant. And so we really tried to integrate. We didn't ask for much. We came, and I wanted to tell that story to honor not only the generation that made that sacrifice to come here, but also to let the other generation know, so that I'm kind of sandwiched in between. I'm not the first generation, right? I was naturalized. I came here as a 6-year-old, but I had the experience of trying to integrate while trying to support the other generation. So really to honor my family, my parents' decision, but also the people that came with us, and to honor the people that were here before us that were resettled right as the war was happening with Iraq and Iran and Saddam's campaign against the Kurds. So that was a big part of the 1980s. I mean, all through the decades, really, the Kurds have been targeted in the Middle East.
And just for some context, Iran and Iraq were in an 8-year war.
Yes.
From 1980 to 1988, if I'm not mistaken.
I believe so. You know, my history isn't perfect because I grew up here learning American history and European history in that context. So, and we didn't have access to the internet. I joke, the way we contacted people back home was they would have to go to a phone booth. They had these coffee shops and areas with phones, and they would rush there, and it had to be an appointment. And I think everyone in my generation.
And they had they look like credit cards.
Yes,
and I'm old enough to remember sort of like the credit cards where you could put them. I remember traveling in Europe in the 90s, and you could put those credit cards in, and you'd have to stock them up.
Exactly. So you had to have cards here and long distance. And even then in 1997, the way we communicated was filming videotapes and sending it back and forth. We learned about my dad's cousin's passing, which was she fell in a waterfall. She was a student. My hometown has beautiful waterfalls. And so we learned that through the tape. My uncles and aunts got married on both sides. My parents were the first married on both sides. So I was the first grandchild on both sides. So when I left, they were very sad. I was 6 years old. I clearly remember it was not an easy decision. We were dealing with the aftermath of the sanctions put on Iraq and after the war, right? And who were, you know, when those sanctions come on countries, they affect the most poor, right? The ones that are, and Kurdish people have always been that minority within the minority in that region.
And just for the geographical context as well, this is a part of Iraq. It's in the very far north, and it borders Turkey.
Yep. So I was born right on that border. And to this day, a lot of conflicts happens on that border. It's an absolutely gorgeous place. I mean, if you look at it through a religious perspective, you could say it's religiously by the three religions, it can be viewed as the Garden of Eden between Tigris and Euphrates, like mountainous, just beautiful on that border. So in that aspect, in Plateau Town I was born in, holds a lot of history, 3,000 years worth of history. I bet, you know, and just very actually multi-religious. So that I grew up with tolerance. I grew up with neighbors. And I think that's what Kurdish people really are, really hospitable and honorable. And I know that's different from what you see in like the news of the Middle East. Like, but when you're truly there and connecting with people, people are not their government. And I think this was the experience for a lot of us. So I remember being told we're going to go. I remember we were terrified. We sold our stuff. My dad worked with the NGOs that were working in the region. So that's, and they were signing people up to be resettled, to have that special asylum that, hey, you've done some work. And my dad was so desperate. I mean, there was no work. We were homeless at times. The poverty rate was intense. And Kurdish people really, I mean, they're farmers. I remember having farms and gardens and walking my grandparents' livestock around. My family had stores in Ahmadiyya, but it was just difficult. I mean, my grandpa had a store. My great-grandfather had a store. I remember him, and I would walk to their stores. But ultimately, my dad had this young family to take care of, and it was really difficult. And so with all the economic turmoil, he's like, we have to find a better future. And it was a scary time because, you know, who knows? I didn't know. I was six. I didn't know anything outside my world. I mean, I was going to school. I was in kindergarten, first grade. And I was the oldest at the time. So we were fortunate to come with community, right? And so being able to be in Guam and create that community of people we knew, because if you know one person from a town or a village, you honor that. You honor a way, like, even if it's just a strong friendship, you honor it as a blood relation. We are very much in that sense where I see a lot of parallels when I study Native American or Indigenous history here, and we compare it to how we treat the land, how we treat family. It's a parallel.
There was a survey that was done about Native Americans and what they're looking for in terms of like news and information. And it's not specific to a tribe. Mm-hmm. Really interested in the diaspora culture,
Yeah. You
know, because as you're describing, there's a shared diaspora mm-hmm. culture that has to do with relationship to the land. So if you're a citizen of the Navajo Nation, then you're probably going to be interested and want to be connected to Native Americans in Alaska.
Yeah. So you have that strong desire to, and that's the one thing with like us too. I mean, Kurdish culture has survived a lot through this decades, through the centuries, because with the way even now Iran treats them, like Gina Mahsen Amin, who was killed a couple of years ago, the overarching identity thing was she was Kurdish, right? That wasn't talked about. She was greater world. She was Iranian, but her real name was Gina, and she was killed because of the regime, but the Kurdish identity played a role. And so music, And storytelling is how this culture has survived. And so that's partially why I did the story, right? Because that's how it survived. And our musicians were kidnapped, tortured for wanting to sing, young ones. And some of that has been preserved. And so, like I said in the documentary, I grew up really trying to integrate and ashamed. I'm like, oh, my parents don't have the great jobs. But then I reflect, even now as a professional, like I have challenges and I had challenges in school and I know the language. And then I look at my dad who was dropped here without education, with all the trauma and PTSD, and nobody talked about it in 1997, and told now make a living. Now make a living, no support. I mean, okay, he went straight to the Federal Butte plant. We stayed home with my mom, who was very young at the time, too. There's a lot to unpack there. But, and we were in an apartment building with people we were in Guam, so that was nice. But we were inside, terrified, until I was able to go to school, summer school. And then beyond that, the challenge for me was my other so-called cousins, the Amedi people, all had older siblings, and all my siblings were really young. So I was, the youngest of them, the oldest of my family. My parents were very young. And so I grew up really trying to integrate and trying to excel. But now I reflect on that. Just my parents were dealing with the trauma, being separated from their families and told, go to work now. You don't know the language. And then they were treated badly at work. And I just remember as soon as I could grasp the language and know how to write, I was filling out applications for my dad. And I was like, and going to him with employers. And it was so challenging. I mean, he started at the Federal Beef plant. Then he went to Olive Garden. And the funny story is a couple of the people that helped resettle us from LSS. Lutheran Social Services. Now I'm meeting in community as I work. And they said when the Amedis came, they all went to work at McDonald's, right? So they called it McAmedi. And I just heard the story last week, which is kind of, yes, that's very true. We were fortunate to have some members here that helped us integrate. But again, Kurdish people didn't ask for a lot. They went to work. They tried to integrate. They didn't rock the boat.
I think that's such a different cultural value when you're navigating a new culture. And you don't know. I mean, in the United States, I think this is a very American value. It's to be aggressive. We're kind of a pushy people.
Yeah.
It's ingrained, that you're supposed to be assertive about what you want, what you need. It's a source of pride, because it's such an individualistic culture that emphasizes individualism. So that's an interesting contrast. Just for clarification, you leave Northern Iraq, Kurdistan.
Mm-hmm.
You go to Guam. How long were you in Guam?
6 months. My brother was actually, one of them was born there. So born in Guam, became a U.S. citizen there.
What is the connection that got you from Guam to
Fargo-Moorhead? Story. So when you're resettled, you try to find family or connection to wherever. So Nashville has a huge Kurdish population. And it's growing. And so my mom's aunt was actually resettled here in her family in Fargo in 1990s, it's around there, really early. And they were here, but then they left because they did face a lot of discrimination, and especially religious discrimination. And so they decided to relocate to Nashville. And so knowing that, the translators, the caseworkers in Guam, we flew to Guam. And it was an interesting dynamic in Guam. We lived in a house with like three other families. We lived in communal living, which is normal for Kurdish people. But we were told, okay, you're going to go to Nashville, Tennessee, because you have family there. And then the Amedis, so all of them have a connection to that mountainous area, Amedie, were like, no, you're coming with us. We had weddings there. We had celebrations. Like, it was 6 months. So we built a home and we built community there. And so to this day, those are very dear friends to me. And I encourage them to tell their stories too. But some were older, some were younger. Like, we had a wedding there. I mean, we had, with what we got and what money we had, which was very little, we really tried to make the best out of it. And I guess that's a Kurdish story. I mean, right there. In the midst of war, refugee camps, resettlement, you're living your life, right? Because you can't stop it. And so,
and I think that's actually really important as well, because, you know, there are, you know, the story of America is the story of immigration. Mm-hmm. It's a story of struggle. It's mm-hmm. a story of discrimination, as you're
yeah.
describing.
Yeah.
There are also these incredible stories of joy.
Yeah.
And I'm so glad that you brought that up to remember that,
yeah.
that despite all of these yeah. struggles, there were incredible moments of joy and connection and family.
Yeah. So, I mean, at home, I didn't feel poor. I didn't feel like I was lacking because we had family. We had community. You know, we went to visit each other even when we resettled here, and we were there for each other. If there was a death, a wedding, we rallied with what we had. But when I went to school, I was like, okay, I don't have a lake place. I don't have grandparents. I don't go to that church, you know. So that's where the difference is.
Well, and I suppose the other thing as well, and I remember this as someone who did not go to a school where it was my first language,
yeah.
was I couldn't go to my parents for help.
Yes.
For homework.
Yeah.
You know, so I had to rely on my friends' parents, and I have very distinctive
yeah.
memories of going to their homes after school. And those are actually our very positive memories where we did our homework together and they
yeah.
helped me.
I remember a little bit of that. I couldn't ask. There wasn't that support. I stayed after school, but I became a reader. I mean, that's where, you know, we didn't have TV, vacations, even to the parks and stuff.
But you remind me of Frank McCourt, who wrote Angela's Ashes.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things that he talks about, great Irish-American
yeah.
writer. And when he gets to New York City, in his sequel to Angela's Ashes, he leaves Ireland. He leaves his horrible poverty.
Yeah.
And he arrives in New York City, and he sees the lions in front of the New York City Public Library.
Yeah.
And he becomes a reader. And eventually
yeah.
an English teacher. He becomes an English teacher at Stuyvesant in high school. But he talks about how the librarians helped him become a reader.
Yeah. And this was, you know, our English as a second language teachers, that all of a sudden a bunch of Almadies were resettled in North Fargo, right? And they were told, you're going to go to Madison Elementary, which I, you know, came full circle and became a tutor in college. But, and the ESL teachers, the patience and the kindness they had, really, you know, they were teaching and now they had a group and they didn't speak the language. And so what was it? It was school. And I think that's a universal thing where you can go to school and learn and read. So I became a reader. I became, as like time went on, being the oldest, it was like, oh, see how I'm smart. I wasn't that smart, but comparatively to everybody else, you know, I was like looked at, oh, she's smart. You know, she's getting the grades. I was working really hard. And interestingly enough, this made my peers angry. So my regular peers with, you know, upper middle class upbringing, okay, you have this girl with a foreign name who's working hard and getting better test scores. They didn't like that. In order to fit in with my peers, because I left the ESL classroom in middle school, I said, my reading comprehension, my vocabulary is better than some of the native speakers, right? And so just trying to integrate that while my peers stayed in the ESL classroom because it created that community, that safety net they needed. And so I was like juggling these things and then juggling home. And
so you would speak a different language at home. You were what's called a third culture
yeah.
kid because you've got feet in two worlds.
Yeah.
Because you've got your home culture.
Yes.
Then you have this experience of, sounds like xenophobia
yeah.
at the school. With the...
Absolutely. I was 6 years old. The first questions my peers asked me, and it's, you know, it speaks to the community here, and nothing wrong with it, was, do you believe in God? Because this idea of if you're foreign, you don't believe the same thing I do, so you must be really different and we need to know. So these are the questions we were asked, and the bullying, you know, and the, I was just there, you know, here was this girl with long dark hair, different name. And like I said, I was, even within our cohort that moved here, we cried a lot. It was difficult. We didn't know the resources. When my sister got hurt and my dad was working 12 hours, we couldn't call 911. So she got burned by hot milk that my mom was boiling to make yogurt. She was trying to get some candy. And her body had all these burns. And we called on our other neighbors that were Kurdish. And then they called our translator, who's been here for a long time, Hamid Alamadi. He's really our community leader. been here since the 1970s, and he called 911. So, you know, there wasn't anybody making that intentional. The caseworkers did the best they could, but we voiced that concern. But nobody said there are additional resources, right? There isn't someone, you know, that mentorship of families really wasn't there. So it's certainly a struggle. It was a unique struggle. And it was survival plus navigating systems. And then I carried that with me through my adolescence while I was trying to be a really good student, be actively involved in community, working, supporting my family. And the most heartbreaking thing for me was I was not enough either at home or in my community.
You seem enough for me right now.
Thank you.
See, I have to ask you, we're going through some really interesting times with immigration right now.
Yes, it's crazy.
How is it affecting your community? And this is an emotional topic. It's really hard for people to talk about the news cycle. And so I'm just curious, is this a topic of conversation in your community?
It is. And so what it is we don't know what's going to happen. Even, like I said, we have the privilege. Our community has the privilege of being naturalized. We went through the process. My parents studied to get their naturalizations while they were working.
Can you tell me about that day when they got their citizenship?
Yeah, it was kind of, it was a process. And my dad was adamant, like, we need to do it. We need to follow the rules. He paid for it, too. A lot of our family friends, because there is, I mean, obviously many, many asylees and refugees don't make enough to pay for paperwork. But he saved to pay for it. He wanted to do it the right way and study. So I remember they would have tutors, and I'm grateful for the support we received. They would have tutors come in and they studied. And, you know, there was this wonderful program with adult basic education that my mom attended with our siblings. So, I mean, there was good things that happened with us. And they, you know, they studied, and it took a while. And 2009, we became citizens, and it was traveling to Minneapolis. It was, and my dad was juggling all these things. And obviously he had I remember they interviewed him because he was outspoken too. He said, wait, you expect me to work, learn the language, do all these things, and I have no support? And so the newspaper came over and did a story on that, I remember. And so they studied and they worked hard. It was nerve-wracking because you're going through the process. You don't feel...
Well, no, there's a test, too.
There's a test.
There's pressure to
get past a test. There's 100 questions that can be asked. And
I never, as born in the United States, I never had to take a test.
Yeah, it's a civics test, right? It's a civics test. And so, 10 questions are going to be asked. And so my parents both took it. And because I was turning 18, through their hard work, then we were naturalized. I just made it, right? If you're on... I'm sorry. I didn't mean to. I'm sure, you know. And so it was, you know, it was a miracle. My mom didn't get a chance to go to school. My dad had a little bit of education through middle school, so he had a little more. But they studied and worked hard. And it's a testament to a lot of people that did the same. And they passed. And it was, of course, background checks and paperwork. It was interesting because a lot of our IDs were made in Guam.
Which is a U.S. territory.
Which is U.S. Well, like, even Iraqi, because Kurdish people didn't have identifications. You got, you know, a oppressive government didn't make identification for a people they didn't recognize, right? So it really made for a difficult, you know, that difficult dynamic. So I remember those stories. But that's why it's to honor, really, this... the incredible resiliency of the groups that have worked towards that. And it's like, okay, we got the citizenship. I remember the way I got sworn in was in a tiny office at the federal building in Fargo. I was in my Hornbacher's uniform going to work, you know, because it wasn't any fanfare. And my picture was taken there. And so there's no fanfare. And so that was okay, though. And it was like, oh, we're citizens. So naturally, we hadn't seen our family in years. So this was after 12 years of being in the States. And I had been working a couple of jobs. And so as a family, we're like, and I remember going to my college orientation and saying, wow, I'm a citizen. I'm going to graduate from high school. I can vote. This is the first time I could vote, too, was in the 08 election. I turned 18 and I was going to graduate high school. So it was like these three big milestones. And we were going to vote. And I remember Obama was on the ticket, and which was monumentous, you know, like you're seeing someone of a different skin color. And so I was excited to vote. And I, you know, going back into my physics class, I walked in and Obama had won the election. It was an interesting dynamic to be an immigrant and poor and trying to fit in. And so that path to naturalization takes a long time. And it's a process. It's not easy. And nobody makes it easy. And you're scared each step.
You're listening to a powerful conversation with Siham Amedi and Prairie Public Director of Radio Ann Alquist. The conversation continues in the second half of Main Street with a discussion on the current climate for immigrants in the U.S. and the importance of preserving stories for future generations. I'm Eric Dethridge, in for Craig Blumenschein, who will be back with you tomorrow. Later on Prairie Plates, Rick Guillon and some Prairie Public colleagues sample the dishes at Thai Coda in Fargo. I promise you will go away hungry. That's all ahead on Main Street, but first, let's catch up on some regional news. You're listening to Main Street on member-supported Prairie Public. I'm Eric Dethridge, in for Craig Blumenschein. We continue our conversation with Prairie Public Director of Radio Ann Alquist and Siham Amedi, whose family came to Minnesota from the Kurdistan region of Iraq back in 1997. She and many other immigrants from the area share their stories in the Prairie Public original documentary Chosen Home, which premieres on April 28th on the television service of Prairie Public.
Let's talk about our present political moment.
Yeah.
It's interesting that you came into, you know, you came into your civic life,
uh-huh,
your citizenship life, as then candidate, then Senator Obama was running for president. We're in a different political environment. There is a laser focus on immigration, specifically the Venezuelan community in the United States. And I'm curious, as someone, you know, with your background and being in your community that has this history of coming to the United States, how are you observing this? What are the conversations going on in your Kurdish diaspora?
Yeah. So again, a lot of individuals are privileged to be citizens. However, there is new Kurdish people from Syria that are being resettled, that were going to be resettled because of the Syrian war, the oppressive Syrian government. They've been in refugee camps for a long time. And so some of that has been stopped. The ones that are here that have been resettled, that I've connected with, are going through the process. They're trying to find support. Now, we are kind of like, do we go visit our family? Because the Kurdish region is okay now. You can actually fly into the Kurdish-Iraqi region to Hawler or Erbil. Safe zone, autonomous. And you have to make those decisions. But what if I go and I've been outspoken and there's a target and then I'm told? Because you can be stopped and you, for any reason, you know, this is kind of like reminiscent of dictatorship that Saddam was in. You would stop, you're talking against, people would disappear in jails. And so we try to keep to ourselves because we're like, okay, don't, I mean, things are going to happen. We've dealt with very different governments in different capacities. And, you know,
and you're still here.
And I'm still here, right? And they're still here. I mean, I think about the generations. I mean, I tell you, there's these stories with this other generation that need to be told. And I'm so motivated. I don't know how, but I want to capture those stories because I'm like, who's going to tell my grandma's stories, you know, in her little village taking care of people? Who's going to tell my mom's story? I don't know, but they're important stories. And so it's a weird time because many of us are naturalized, but many of us have families that are hoping for visas to come and visit or for us to go visit. And there's some limbo. And then others that were hopeful that maybe would have gotten the green card lottery. So that's opened up in Iraq and other countries now. And people don't understand the dynamic of that process, the green card lottery. You get a green card permanent residency to come to in the States and work. And you have to self-fund. That is self-funded. That is not an asylee or refugee. And so programs like that, that professionals sometimes are looking for, and countries that really have been decimated because of foreign policy and things like that, that dream has completely shut down for a lot of people because that's been shut down. So a lot of disheartened, like, hope is gone for many. And I just, if we could have a way of how my family was immigrated, which is 6,000 people that were given the opportunity because of what had happened during the war to resettle and rebuild, that would be amazing. But that system doesn't exist anymore. And the system is so backlogged. And so out of desperation, people are taking this journey, which, again, I find myself in a place of privilege because I didn't have to take that journey.
During the panel discussion, there's a panel discussion after the film.
Mm-hmm.
And you commented on this, as you said on the panel, where you were looking at the other people's stories like, I could never have done that. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were people who had made these decisions to trek on foot, just get out of really bad, really violent situation. Their lives were at risk as adults, you know, not speaking any English or a lot of English, or spoke English, but there was just so much uncertainty. Plus having a family to take care of.
Yeah.
I remember there was a gentleman who was, I believe he was an interpreter for the U.S. Army in Iraq, and then, you know, needed to leave. And, you know, he just had to leave. He had to take the jump. There was just no other alternative. And I remember him saying at some point during the film that there's really not a home that he goes. It's just wherever he's at. And the family. It just comes down to making the family safe, ultimately. And that seemed to really resonate with you, where you thought, I had it pretty good.
Yeah. I mean, compared to some of the stories that were told of people making that decision, those adults, like my dad had to make that decision, the adults we had to come with, I was just, I cried. It was the first time I was on a plane, you know, as a kid. I was like, okay, these adults are taking care of everything. And again, how do you honor that? How do you honor that? And how do you break those stereotypes? Because I think the word immigrant is now synonymous with something bad, right? You're an immigrant. A lot of people's minds goes to, especially brown immigrants. Let's just say that xenophobia, racism definitely is associated with that. Like, you are here to hurt us or take our resources or whatever, not knowing that many of them. I mean, I just was asked by a friend who said, oh, we have this new individual from Kurdistan. We're looking for a translator. He's ready to go to work and be a maintenance technician at the school. So doing that cleaning, and he's motivated, ready to go. And I think you see that reflective in a lot of different industries here. You know, it's where they're coming, they're working, they're grateful. And so we don't see that positivity reflected. This region has a history of that. Like I said, my dad came and worked, and his friends, Federal Beef Plant, the restaurants, and they made light of it, right? And they were poor comparative to the average person living in Fargo-Moorhead. They didn't have anything, but they made light of it. And we had some good times. We still do as a community.
I've asked you, you know, why you left, why your family left. You've been in Fargo-Moorhead now for 25 years,
Yeah, 28.
28 years. Why do you stay?
Because it's home now. Because my parents were able to find a little bit of stability in comparative to other places. There's no way I can go live in a big city. I was told if I work hard, if I want to be a part of this community, that I'll be accepted. You know, and we're still working on that. But it's a little scary when you're dealing with so many uncertainties to then just move again, right? You don't want to go through not having any support. So especially being an oldest, and I joke about this a lot, the oldest daughter of an immigrant family. There's so much to unpack there. Cultural expectations and community expectations.
I mean, you're in a caregiving role.
Caregiving, absolutely, for not only the siblings, but the parents. And you're supposed to spearhead a lot of stuff. Hispanic friends have the same experience that I've met it through education and employment. It's not, hasn't been the easiest, but it's home. And we're grateful to be a part of the community. We're grateful to be accepted. But again, it's still, it's a little nuanced because when I look at it from a systematic approach and how people are treated now that I'm in the other side of things, I get a little frustrated, but I look at the bigger picture.
Sam Amadi is one of the storytellers in Chosen Home, a Prairie Public local production. Let's keep the conversation going. This has been fantastic.
Yeah, this was great. And, I, you know, there are more stories beyond mine. And I am interested to see how this actual second generation now. That's why I try to tell the story and get things out there, is to educate that generation that has it really good now. And then honor the older generation with all those sacrifices. And there was a period of time for 7 days my parents fled into the mountains to maybe we were going to get gas, maybe we weren't, and survived. And I was just a baby. So again, I'm just the holder of these experiences and stories.
Well, the United States is a great place for that because if there's one thing we all cherish as Americans, it's our history.
Absolutely.
Siham Amedi in conversation with Prairie Public Director of Radio Ann Alquist. With firsthand accounts and archival photos, Prairie Public's original documentary Chosen Home, which Sihan is very much a part of, explores immigrant and refugee experiences, their challenges, successes, and how their experiences have shaped their new life in Minnesota. You can catch the premiere on April 28th on Prairie Public's television service as well as Prairie Public's YouTube channel.
I like bagels.
Eat some barbecue.
Applesauce and some nice red beets.
It's time for Prairie Plates with our resident food expert and founder of a very popular foodie Facebook group, Fargo Moorhead Eats, Rick Guion. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Eric. Good to be with you this week.
So you were kind enough the other day to invite me, as well as Christine and Kirsten from our communications department, to an eatery that looks pretty unassuming from the outside, but inside it's a colorful hub of flavors. Thailand is hot right now. Like, literally, it's 92 degrees in Bangkok and it's only early April. And let me tell you, that's not a dry heat.
You want to live in Taiwan?
Parker, no, it's Thailand. It's also on fire because of a certain HBO Schadenfreude TV series that just had its season finale on Sunday about a very flawed, very wealthy group of folks vacationing at a Four Seasons-like resort in the Southeast Asian paradise. You could also feel the Thai heat right here in North Dakota, but in an understated Midwestern kind of way.
We have 1 to 5 for spicy. 3 is a medium. I can eat 3.
Yeah.
But if more than 3, I cannot. Yeah.
Probably a lot of ones. Right?
Yeah.
The modest near-downtown Fargo restaurant, Thai Coda, sits adjacent to a taco shop called T's and a gas station. They're all housed in the same building. Its owners, TJ and Gina Edra, care so much about funkifying their dishes, they shut down for a couple of weeks to travel to Thailand each year in search of new flavors and spices, which will eventually make their way to your plate, as it did with Christine McClellan, Kirsten Ness, and Prairie Plate's Rick Guion and I. Here's TJ introducing what we're about to enjoy.
Traditionally served with this green sauce here. It's like a herbal sauce. There's mint, basil, Thai chili, and cilantro in there, a little palm sugar. So that's what we serve our spring rolls with. This is pad kerpao tofu. I made this one special for you guys because I was at the local Asian market and they had holy basil there. The holy basil is kind of like more common in Thai, so it's easier availability. That's why they use it a lot in Thai. It's a little more spicy than Thai basil. Thai basil is a little more sweet than this one. This one's a little more spicy. Goes good with this kerpao. Khao soy curry is special to us because it's a northern Thai curry. It's special to the region where my wife is from. She's from Chiang Rai. The curry paste, we get it from her hometown. That's what makes it kind of special for us.
Yeah, if you like spicy, we have the chili oil for you.
The last one is the papaya salad. This one we made for you is som tam pu. Som tam is the papaya salad. Pu is crab. The crab in there, it's a fermented crab, and then it gives it a really nice, like, pungent umami flavor to it. So, enjoy.
Oh, and enjoy it we did.
Mm, so good. So fresh. Crunchy. This mint sauce is so good with it. I think there's also, or maybe I'm tasting the basil. It's really herby too.
Mm-hmm.
The spring roll, even without the sauce, yeah.
This is the tofu with fried holy basil, cucumbers, fried egg on rice. And this is a specialty TJ had recently in Thailand, specifically in Bangkok, he said. So he's serving it to us today. It looks and smells fantastic. The egg on top adds to the umami factor. Yeah, it looks great.
I got the khao soy curry with tofu. It's probably my favorite dish in town, or at least like top five. And so anytime I come here, I have to get the khao soy curry.
This is only my second time at Thai Coda. The first time I went with Christine too. So I'm happy to be back. I did order the same thing as well, the khao soy. I'm excited. Yellow curry is very good.
I'm being adventurous today with this fermented crab.
Ooh, yeah.
The flavor of the dish is very good. The spice level is good. The sweet, sour, salty is good. And that's what you look for with Thai food, is the sweet, sour, salty factor.
The tickets are coming, aren't they?
The tickets are coming.
Things could get a little salty in the kitchen as the lunch rush really heats up. Pretty impressive for a Monday, actually. But even with the numerous tickets lining up on the hooks one after the other, the open kitchen stays cool thanks to the ease at which TJ, Gina, and their team orchestrated this aromatic symphony of flavors in pretty short order. Talk about multitasking, they still had time to talk to Rick and me.
So tell me the origin story of this restaurant.
I've been working in Fargo for about 20 years. I worked at Wano's for 10 years. If you guys ever remember Wano's downtown, then I worked at Wasabi for 10 years and I learned how to do sushi there. And then after Wasabi, COVID happened and this little restaurant was vacant for a good year. And we asked around and we found out we knew who the owners were. And we rented it out and opened this little Thai restaurant. My wife's dream was always to run her own little Thai restaurant, so we just did it, you know?
So you picked the time of, like, the worst, pandemic
in
history to open up a restaurant. What made you think you could be as successful as you obviously are, looking at the crowd here?
We eat Thai food all over, and my wife always made the food a little different. And I was like, oh, why don't we do it your style, Northern Thai style, and bring it to Fargo? And we thought that was a good concept, and it seems like everybody really likes it. And we're kind of low key, and we're not like full service here. We're not like kind of fancy, you know, with servers and everything. We do everything takeout mostly, and we make the prices reasonable for everybody. And we do everything in takeout boxes. I think people like the fast casual, you know, version of Thai.
So for the uninitiated, on the sign it says Northern Thai cuisine. What's the difference between Northern and other regions of the country?
The difference is, like, what's available. For example, like, Northern Thai is more mountain and forest and stuff. So it's a lot of, like, earthy flavors that they get from growing in the ground in the forest and the mountains. When you get to Bangkok in the central of Thailand, that's kind of a mixed plate of all of Thai. And then Southern Thai is, like, really spicy. Eastern Thai is more, like, funky flavors and stuff. But Northern Thai has, like, it's more earthy.
The food in Chiang Rai, actually not spicy that much. We make a lot of vegetable, like a soup.
People are always looking for authentic, real ethnic food, and this is one of the places. They bring back paste, sauces, recipes, all sorts of stuff from Thailand.
They've definitely built a following, especially in downtown here, and are well known for just well-executed dishes, and it's really kind of a special hole in the wall.
Fargo's reputation as a hotbed for hot dish is, okay, true, but evolving.
Yeah, we're not too far away from a really large Asian market, which is the largest in the Dakotas.
Oh.
And the products range from Asian products to African, Indian,
all sorts of stuff.
In other words, you don't have to travel to Minneapolis or Winnipeg for a global spectrum of flavors. And that's pretty hot.
People just need to get out and try some of this great cuisine here.
If you fly over Fargo, you might go hungry.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 9th. No proposed tariff has ever been universally popular among all Americans. In the early 1900s, a tariff proposal highlighted the tensions between differing interests. Many Americans supported tariffs to discourage monopolies from raising prices. Industrialists believed tariffs on foreign products would protect their business interests. However, a tariff that protected one interest could harm another. New England, which produced no coal, opposed a tariff on that product. But Pennsylvania, a major coal producer, strongly supported the tariff. On this date, in 1909, Congressman Cyrano Payne introduced a new tariff bill that raised hundreds of rates. President Taft signed the bill, expecting it to stimulate the economy by protecting American businesses. However, the country was far from united on the subject. The Bismarck Tribune noted, "The more the tariff is argued, the more it is apparent that it is a local issue." North Dakota farmers had mixed feelings about the tariff, but were generally in favor, believing it would make imported agricultural products more expensive and protect the market for homegrown products, helping to stabilize the markets. Politicians recognized the importance of addressing the farmers' concerns. They acknowledged that placing a tariff on some products, like corn, was hardly defensible on any ground except the political effect they may possibly have on the farmer vote. Sugar was another contentious product. Beet farmers strongly favored a tariff on imported refined sugar, while sugar refiners opposed it. North Dakota newspapers reflected these mixed feelings, but generally defended the tariffs. The Ward County Independent stated that while tariffs would increase the cost of luxury goods, the rate for necessities would be reduced. The Payne-Aldrich tariff had a significant impact on American consumers. Tariffs on imported agricultural products were designed to benefit farmers and keep prices down for consumers. However, this was offset by increased costs for farm equipment due to a tariff on steel and iron. As a result, farmers had to raise their prices to maintain their financial stability. Furthermore, the tariff did not address some of the more serious issues facing farmers, like overproduction, unsustainable land use, and mounting debt. Farmers were already feeling increased pressure, and the Great Depression and the Dust Bowl were still looming on the horizon. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Ann Alquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Support for Bray Public is provided by Jade Presents, bringing the Avid Brothers and the Milk Carton Kids to Bluestem Amphitheater in Moorhead, Saturday, August 30th.
There ain't no man can't save me. There ain't no man.
Ticket information at jadepresents.com. And by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, dedicated to producing reliable electricity. Basin Electric operates generation stations in North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana, and Wyoming, including wind projects in North and South Dakota. Coming up Friday afternoon on Prairie Public.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on The Middle, we're approaching the first 100 days of Trump's presidency, and so much has happened.
The president is now considering a plan to eliminate the Department of Education.
The U.S. will take over the Gaza Strip.
We need Greenland.
I think I'm not allowed to run again. I'm not sure. Am I allowed to run again?
So how are you feeling about the first 100 days? We're taking your calls next time on The Middle.
Always a lively discussion and very timely topics. The Middle with Jeremy Hobson, Friday at 3 p.m. Central, 2 Mountain, here on Prairie Public. That's it for this edition of Main Street. Hope you enjoyed the show. I'm Eric Etheridge. It's been fun pinch hitting for Craig Blumenschein. He will be back with you tomorrow. He'll feature a movie review of the, well, let's just face it, mostly panned Disney's new version of Snow White. Our own resident critic Matt Olean has his take on it, so join us tomorrow on Main Street at 3 and 7 p.m. Central on Prairie Public. Have a great rest of your Wednesday.